Final case on the calendar is the State of Croker.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Dubs Hirschlip. I'm appearing on behalf of Bill Croker, an estate of Henry, the estate of Edward Croker, his father. We're here because of due process rights to notice and opportunity to be heard, as well as equal justice, even for the disabled, where there was an erroneous summary judgment ruling based on a 4-month statute of limitations, stripping my client of all of his rights and his interests in his father's estate, where the court deemed the PR's deliberate failure, to give notice to one of the heirs of the probate.
Did he actually receive notice? Didn't he receive notice in July of 2015?
Bill actually received notice in March, on March 20th, from Angela Fair, a third sure. party, and then after filing his will contest claim and after hearing and opposition by attorney for the PR, then the attorney for the PR on or about July 10, which wasn't raised in any of opposing counsel's briefings. But yes, they did, after the expiration of the 4-month statute, they did actually issue a written notice to Bill.
Okay, so how does that affect the running of the statute?
Yeah. Thank you. I think that demonstrates the capacity of the PR and the PR's attorney to have given Bill notice at any time. Number one. Number two, the statute says that the notice has to be given within 20 days of the probate. So just simply the timing defies compliance with the statute. And then finally, it was after the statute of limitations ran. We have a 4-month statute of limitations, and if you give people entitled to notice after the statute of limitations ran, it's essentially no notice. So I think it's really a non-event, that July notice. But it's interesting, also in July, opposing counsel appeared at a hearing noted by Bill for this will contest claim and submitted defenses, including subject matter jurisdiction, and this is at clerk's papers 203 and 204, and actually waived defenses based on personal jurisdiction, personal service, failure of service of process. So a probate expert, Bruce Moen, raises the defense of subject matter jurisdiction, that is, that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, which is completely antithetical to the Washington Constitution granting original jurisdiction over all matters of probate to the Superior Court. So in no, and this has been reaffirmed in case after case in Washington, in no instance does a Superior Court not have subject matter jurisdiction over a probate in Washington where either there's real estate or a decedent is a resident of Washington. So that defense is not the same as a personal jurisdiction defense. And CR 12B-H1 says that if you don't raise those specific defenses initially, you waive them. So we have a situation where the statute of limitations claim, which...
Let me back up just a second then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
There's so many Cokers.
Let's just go with Bill. Yeah, it'll get really messy. We have right. Bill, Ed, and Michael.
So Bill first filed his will contest claim in June.
June 11th.
And that would have been before the statute of limitations ran. Is that right?
That is correct, John.
Okay. And under the statute, when he filed that, the statute of limitations would have been told for 90 days. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
To allow him to effect personal service.
Correct, right? Your Honor.
Okay. And did he do that?
Well, that's a great question, because this specific kind of case, not only is the statute of limitations completely peculiar to this kind of case, but also the notice procedure is completely peculiar. I don't know of another single case where you have to go to the clerk to pay $20 to get them to issue a citation. What's a citation? The clerk issues a citation to all interested parties, and that substitutes a summons. So this is an arcane procedure that most lawyers don't even know about, and that's the procedure that an illiterate and allegedly mentally incapacitated individual, Bill, couldn't figure out, nor could he, with the help of his sister, figure it out. And so, no, the only service we have is a substantial service. And I think I might have miscited the defendant's defenses, because I think I'm seeing that the service was at CP 203 and 204, which is simply certified mail return receipt requested. But that's what stimulated opposing counsel then to appear and oppose Bill's will contest. So, in fact, the PR did have actual notice, which is the same standard that's being used against Bill.
So is there anything in this statute that provides for a tolling of the statute limitations based on some sort of disability?
Not currently, Your Honor. Historical versions, prior versions of the statute, have had express language.
For unsound mind.
For unsound mind, and really, I think it's important to notice the other categoricals that were included in that prior version included unmarried women as deemed incapacitated, and so their rights were tolled under the statute until that was cured.
And the legislature removed that.
Correct. Removed all of the language right. in whole, and only
so
for
why how can this court then amend the statute to add that back into an exception to the statute of limitations or a tolling of the statute of limitations?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that this is a struggle from my perspective as a trial attorney. I can't necessarily lobby the legislature to make a better decision here, but we do have the U.S. Constitution and the Washington Law Against Discrimination, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and GR 33, all of which say that legislatures make mistakes sometimes when it comes to equal protection of rights for people, and when those laws passed by the legislature trod on the rights of disabled people's access to justice, then it is up to this court to assert the dominance of that of those laws, Washington Law Against Discrimination, Americans with Disabilities Act, GR 33, over a frankly unconstitutional statute. I have very little time left, so I'm going to thank you and sit down.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Howard Goodfriend for the respondent, Michael Coker, the personal representative of the estate of Ed Coker. RCW 1124.010 is clear and unambiguous in that a claimant has 4 months from the admission of a will to probate to file a petition contesting the validity of a will. Another 90 days, it's told, for service, to perfect service of process. And in most recently, I think in the Jessman case, the Supreme Court held unequivocally that there are no exceptions, that the service and filing provisions are essential to the court acquiring authority to adjudicate the case, and that the personal representative could not waive an objection or waive the requirements of the statute even by waiting over a year.
So you take the position that the Supreme Court case governs the outcome in this case?
Yes, it does. In terms of the waiver provisions and arguments in terms of the authority of the court to adjudicate a will contest and in terms of strict compliance with 1124.010 as opposed to substantial compliance.
Now,
absolutely.
The Supreme Court did not address the argument that's being made about tolling based on disability.
No, it did not. As Judge Spearman indicated, the statutory provision has been removed. The tolling provision under the general tolling provision in Title IV, I think it's 416190, applies to actions mentioned in this chapter, so that doesn't apply. And in any event, we have on this record no evidence that despite allegations of learning disability, difficulty reading, and a failure to complete high school, that Bill Coker is incompetent or disabled to such a degree that he or she cannot understand the nature of the proceedings.
The trial court never ruled on that issue.
The trial court never ruled on that issue. But the record, I think, does not allow even an inference that that determination can be made, where he repeatedly appeared and participated in these proceedings, was able to hire counsel, was able to file what he termed a creditor's claim, and was receiving Social Security checks in his own name directly, because he was incompetent to manage his affairs. And in fact, the only disability that's documented on this record is a knee injury based on an L&I claim.
So what happens if your client does not exercise due diligence to provide service and then fails to provide service within or notice within the statute of limitations? Is it told, or does the statute just run?
If there is no notice, if there's no actual notice, the statute, and that's a matter of due process, and that's what this court held in Little and what the Supreme Court held in Hestagen, I believe. So, but let's talk about what notice there was. And I apologize that we didn't cite this in the brief, but the appellant cited it in theirs. Even if you toll it until the date that notice was received, by formal notice, not talking about his actual notice, because he admits that he found out in March 2000.
You mean the notice on July 10th?
The notice on July 10th at CP 446. If you use that date and start the 4 months from that date, well after he's even made the allegations that the will is a forgery, there is still no timely petition under 11-24010, because the petition thereafter wasn't filed until November 30th. And there's no timely service. You're still run up right in the face of Jepson, and the case has to be dismissed by the plain terms of 11-24010. So it doesn't matter if you use the date he actually appeared in court in June, the date he admitted that he had notice, which was in March, or even the latest date when the notice was given by the personal representative's attorney, Mr. Moen, after he appeared, which was July. There is still...
Well, I think his argument is that the July notice did not have any effect because it didn't comply with the statutory requirement.
We know from two cases that a failure to give notice can be cured by subsequent notice. The first one is the State of Walker. It's cited in our brief. It's a Division III case at 10 Washap 925. The second one, which we didn't cite because when we wrote the brief, you couldn't cite these cases, is a Division III case that came out later than that, and it's a State of Peterson. And I can provide it by RAP 10.8 authority after argument, but it's noted at 175 WASHAP 1012.
This is persuasive.
It's persuasive, and it relies on Walker. And it basically says, you know, you might not have given notice in compliance with the 20 days. And the 20 days is under 11-28237. There are two statutes here. 11-24010 doesn't talk about notice. And what the court has said is that it's told when there's no notice, not as a matter of statute, but as a matter of due process of law. 11-28237 deals with entirely different subject matter. It talks about, it's basically addressed to creditors' claims and notice for that purpose. But basically it says, you know, within 20 days, the PR has to give notice. But none of the cases say that, you know, the failure to give notice within 20 days means that the statute is told indefinitely. The only thing that it says, and Walker says this in a published opinion at 10 WASHAP 925, that a failure to give notice in compliance with the statute can be cured by providing the notice any time thereafter. That's exactly what happened here. And Mr. Moen, I think, recognized that even though, and let's set aside the lack of notice under the first admission of the will to probate. But when he came in and we now had Bill appearing. We had an address for him. He gives notice in compliance with the statute, and there's still a delay in excess of 4 months before a will contest is filed. That is fatal to his claim. But even if you look at the first one.
Why wouldn't the fact that he'd already filed something, you know, back in June, so when he gets notice in July, why isn't the one that you think he has to file something new?
What he has to do is there has to be both service, both filing and service within 90 days. So, I mean, he's got neither. It's not told indefinitely. I mean, you have to pick one or the other. Either he has to file a new petition, which he did late, or if he used the old creditor's claim that we're calling a petition now, there's still no personal service.
He didn't affect personal service until December.
He didn't affect personal service until well after November 30th when he filed the petition. So, I mean, that's what Jepson says. You can email it. You can mail it. It doesn't matter. If you don't affect personal service within 90 days, it is void for purposes of giving the court authority to adjudicate your petition. And, you know, that was a closely decided decision. It was 5-4, and it was harsh and criticized by the majority. But it was only a year and a half ago, and it is the law in the state of Washington about what is required to perfect a will contest. And the other point I'd like to make is you don't have to give actual notice in order to start the clock running. You just have to exercise due diligence. And, you know, there is on record affidavits that state that nobody knew where this guy was. He hadn't been seen in years. He'd been estranged from the family.
There's also evidence that an internet search could have found him, too.
It's conflicting. Right. It's conflicting. Actually, what the evidence was that an internet search would have shown addresses for him, right, whether they were current or not, nobody is stating. So, I would concede that the evidence on that was somewhat disputing. But I don't think it matters because of the requirement of strict compliance in this record. In terms of the other allegations of incompetency and the law against discrimination, we're going to stand on our briefs on that. Even if you accept that it could implement tolling, it just does not rise to the level on this record of incompetence in terms of failure to understand or participate in the legal proceedings at issue. For those reasons, we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
I have very short time, so I'm going to start out with contextualizing that whatever we're talking about followed a phone call threat from the PR. In April, the PR picked up his phone, dialed his brother's number, and threatened him physically and financially to not make a claim in the probate court. That's the level of deliberate failure to give notice to my client we're talking about. Then, after opposing party hires the best attorney in the state, perhaps, on probate, Bruce Moen, he comes in, fancy litigation, and gets the court to threaten Bill, who obviously isn't getting it, to not come back. Do not come back in this courtroom or I will fine you, is what the judge says. Judge then hears Bill say, oh, but Your Honor, I'm slow. Which isn't exactly anything other than, well, it's an opportunity for inquiry. What do you mean by slow? Which is what is required in this case under the ADA, without exceptions. We can get into the exceptions to Jepson. Okay, we can, and I'm happy to talk about that, but there is no exception to the duties, the court's duty to inquire about a disability once given notice. It is unacceptable the way the court treated Bill in that commissioner's hearing room. The judge recognized in their own conduct that there was some request for accommodation because the judge responded. It wasn't just muttered and then walked out and lost to the hearing. The judge said, oh, well, the WSBA has pro bono services. Why don't you call them? In fact, the WSBA does not have pro bono services. There's no specialized list. There's no hotline. There's just a general attorney directory that you then get to call every single attorney in your area and ask if they're willing to accept your case. That's what the judge offered him. Call every attorney in the county and see if they're willing to accept your case. That's the accommodation that was made here. And GR 33 unconditionally requires a court who's been given notice of a disability, they have to make inquiry, and they have to put it on the record. any of the judges that saw this case, whether it was that summer, July summer case or hearing, or whether it was a summary judgment hearing in February of 2015, February of 2016, that they could have said something, they could have inquired, they could have made findings, they could have had some decision. We submitted evidence. We have a doctor's note. We have school records, and then the family feud. We get a bunch of declarations from the family saying, no, he doesn't have mental disabilities. Okay, that's a dispute of fact. Not resolvable in summary judgment. But there was no finding. It wasn't even addressed. It was completely ignored. And that is what the ADA is intended to do, is to not allow disabled to be ignored by our justice system. My client is entitled to equal access, just as if he was as capable as the PR, and that's not what happened here. Thank you.